Hi, everybody, and welcome to The Stone Chapel, a podcast of the staff and friends of the Lanier Theological Library in Houston, Texas. My name is David Capes. I'm the Senior Research Fellow at the Library and your host for this series of podcasts. Our purpose is fairly simple. We want to bring to you great conversations with leading experts from around the world on biblical, theological, historical, and archaeological themes. Well, the list goes on. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. Joining me today on the Stone Chapel is Dr. Carmen Joy Imes, who is an associate professor of Old Testament at Prairie College up there in Alberta. Now, for those who don't know where Alberta is, Carmen, where is it?
We are north of Montana.
North of Montana. Okay, up in Canada where it gets really, really cold.
Yes.
Yes, and we're in the winter, so you probably have snow on the ground.
We do, although a lot of it melted yesterday. We are now above freezing, which is pretty exciting. There's slush and puddles.
Slush and puddles, and you'll be doing slush and puddles for quite a while, I imagine.
Yes, and great jubilation.
Great jubilation, yeah. Well, we're talking about your book, Bearing God's Name, Why Sinai Still Matters. It's a terrific book. I'd recommend it because it reads well, first of all. It's really engaging, and you tell some great stories. But it's published by InterVarsity Press. Carmen, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so I tell students every good book has a big idea. What's the big idea of your book?
The big idea of my book is that Christians can't know who we are or what we're here to do in the world without the Old Testament, and specifically without an understanding of what happened at Mount Sinai. So I take readers back to Mount Sinai. We look at what happens there as God draws his people into covenant with himself and gives them the law. And I argue that the law is not their means of earning salvation, but that it's their mission. In order to represent God in the world, this is how they are to live.
By and through the law, or
yes.
Torah, which
yes.
may better be translated something else. We'll talk about that in a minute.
Yeah.
Now, there are Christians who don't read the Old Testament very much. There are whole denominations that say, well, you know, you don't really need that.
Yeah.
But you're saying sort of the opposite, that no, we really do need that part.
We do. Yeah, and I believe that there are lots of things in the Old Testament that we might find objectionable or difficult to understand or even just boring. But I think if we're willing to wrestle with the text and understand it on its own terms, there are so many insights that it has to offer to us about what does it mean to live as the people of God.
Well, this was Jesus's Bible, after all.
Yes.
This was Paul's Bible. When Paul quoted the Old Testament about 100 times in his letters.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's constantly referring to them as the scriptures, that which
yes.
Moses wrote, what Isaiah said,
yep.
and those kind of things. So, I mean, if we just think about our founders, we have to say, gosh, we really need an up-close and personal relationship to the Old Testament. Now, I remember hearing, and these numbers are a little fuzzy, there was a professor of preaching who surveyed all of these evangelical churches and discovered about 82% of the sermons were from the New Testament. About
18%. Not surprised.
Does that sound about right to you?
That sounds about right. In fact, 18% might be generous for Old Testament.
So your goal, it sounds like, is to get us as Christians to read the Old Testament. And so even that name, the Old Testament, it sounds like it's worn out. It sounds like it's used up. It sounds like it's yesterday's news, right?
Yeah.
Do we need a new term for that?
You know, I've heard various scholars suggest other terms like First Testament.
Right.
Or Hebrew Bible is another way to refer to it. I think First Testament would be a great way to refer to it. I'm just in such a rut. It'd be hard to break out of my rut.
It would be. And you'd have to go back to all these Bibles that have been published, millions of them, and redo it.
Right.
One of the things is that you talk a lot about is the fact that there is grace in the law.
Yes. Yes.
And again, we're going to come back to that term law in just a minute. One of the things that my rabbi friend told me many years ago, and I keep repeating it to students, is that law for Jews in Judaism, law is not the means of salvation. Mm. It is the presence of salvation.
Mm.
Does that ring true to you as you've studied this closely? I would certainly agree.
It is not the means of salvation. It's interesting to call it the presence of salvation. I'm wondering what your friend meant by that.
I think, you know, because you talk about it and others as well as sort of the blueprint of life. This is this is what a good society looks like, what a good world looks like, right?
Yes.
I don't think he's defining salvation in terms of redemption out of Egypt as so much as he is, well, in living our Torah observant lives, we are to... that it creates life for us here and now.
Yes.
That is a life worth living.
Yes. I think, and it's not just in abstract, like this is an abstractly good life that we could live. But I think what we see in the law is the specific parameters that are necessary in order for God to move into the neighborhood. If if God is going to come live among us, then we need to be a holy people. And here's what it looks like to be a holy people. And the reason why we're living as a holy people is because God has appointed us as this kingdom of priests and his treasured possession. We are, our vocation is to represent him among the nations. And the laws are the particular ways we do that in all the different areas of life.
When I was a little boy, I remember going to Sunday school and such, and they said, okay, the Bible, the Old Testament is 39 books, and there's five divisions. There's law, and there's writings, and there's law, and then history, and then writings, and major prophets, and minor prophets.
Yeah.
But it was always law first. But you make the case that the word Torah is really not best translated law, because we have an idea of what law is, ensconced in books and legal legislation and such.
Yes.
But that law is something else. What is that something else?
Well, more broadly speaking, Torah refers to instruction. And so God gives instruction in lots of ways. In fact, some would argue that the narratives, the stories we get in the Bible are a means of instruction, and that the Psalms are a means of instruction. So Torah is much broader than just do this and don't do that. We can learn God's wisdom in lots of different genres and different ways.
I think about the Joseph narratives and all of the things that happen in that. Mm-hmm. And there's very little that is sort of legal at that point, right? And I think John Walton and others make the case that the word law is really not the best way. We need a new way. Teaching instruction really might well be the very best that we can do with that.
And even the parts that we would label as law, like these are specifically like do this or don't do that, even those, I don't think law is the best term for, because of what you've already said. We have an idea in our minds about what is meant by legislation that's enforced in a court of law. And and in ancient Israel, law functioned differently, or Torah functioned differently. These instructions from God were meant to be the source for wise reflection on how to please him. They weren't fixed in the same way that our laws are fixed today.
So when the judges judged, how did they use Torah, you think?
You know, we're not given a lot of specific examples. We don't get to see it in action very often. But I think what they would do is they would derive principles from the laws. They would read what God spoke through Moses at Sinai, and they would use that to help them sort of figure out the boundaries around behavior, what's wise behavior and what's unwise behavior. But even when there's a penalty attached to the Sinai instructions, the penalty doesn't have to be invoked or enforced every time. If somebody's repentant, they don't have to stone the person to death, right?
Right.
So
that's a good thing, right?
Yeah. So there are lots of cases where, you know, we see David commits adultery, but he's not stoned to death afterwards.
He's
repentant, and so that's not necessary. I think we see some examples of how the law is meant to be a guidance for life. Not that it's just take it or leave it. It's God's definitive judgment on what is good and what is not good in that cultural context. So it's not as though it's optional, but the way that you deal with someone who violates this there's flexibility there.
Flexibility. I remember hearing Ted Koppel many years ago, who was a news, I think he was an ABC News correspondent and anchor, but he said it's not the 10 suggestions is the Ten Commandments, right?
Right.
And a lot of your book deals with the Ten Commandments. I mean, particularly, and we're going to come to that, taking the name of the Lord in vain. But I love the way that you talked about the commandments as community protections. It's really protection for the community.
Yes.
Give a little bit of sense of what you mean by that and how it plays out.
Yeah, well, I'll borrow here the words of Daniel Block, who is my dissertation advisor at Wheaton. He calls the Decalogue or the Ten Commandments the Bill of Other People's Rights. That is, it's not protecting the rights of the male head of household, but it's constraining his power and using it on behalf of those in his sphere of influence. So you're not allowed to take what belongs to your neighbor. You're not even allowed to lust after it. You're not allowed to take someone's life or to mar their reputation. Maybe my favorite example of this is the Sabbath law. The Sabbath law is not about I get a break, but I am required to give a break to everyone
break.
Who's in my household, right?
Exactly,
so
yeah.
If I'm a head of household, which I wouldn't have been in ancient Israel, but if I'm the head, a male head of household, and I have servants, male and female servants in my household and a wife and children, then all of them get a break too. It's not just me who gets a break on the Sabbath. So I think in many ways, God is trying to rein in the power of those who are at the top of the heap and create the conditions by which others can flourish.
Can flourish as well. I've always thought it's so interesting that you take these people who had known slavery so much for 400 and something years, right? And then one of the things that God says first is, I want you to rest. And you're commanded to rest, right? And that had to be very strange.
Yes.
Because in their whole way of life, it was, you know, you've got to put out, you've got to work, you know, you've got to.
And this is where the commands are revolutionary and where we see the grace of God. God is not enslaving them in the way that Pharaoh did, even though the same word is used. At the beginning of Exodus, they are the Eved of Pharaoh. They are serving Pharaoh. And by the end of the book, they're serving Yahweh. But Yahweh is a completely different kind of ruler. He doesn't exploit them. He provides for them graciously. And then he tells them, one day a week, you're to sit back and rest in my provision, which I think it remains a challenge for us today to hold back one day a week and recognize the world does not revolve around me and the world does not depend upon me. So I can rest and God will provide.
That's pretty liberating when you think
is.
About it. It's not all about me and what I can provide and what I can do. And,
exactly.
And the whole idea of the manna is so great with that as well. Well, let's make sure, I want to make sure that we talk about the title of the book is Bearing God's Name, Why Sinai Still Matters. So we've got to talk about that commandment that is often translated, do not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. So you say that we've sort of misunderstood that.
I think so.
What does it mean then? If we've misunderstood it, where's the misunderstanding and what does it really mean after all?
Well, this is the command that I spent 5 years at Wheaton College studying for my doctoral work. And, you know, most people out there, me included, have thought that this command is telling us not to say God's name in a certain way. But the Hebrew the Hebrew of this command doesn't say anything about speech. It just says, you shall not carry or bear the name of Yahweh your God in vain. And so I went on an investigation to see what would it mean if this wasn't about speech. Like, there's no clues about speech here in this verse. So what could this possibly mean? And I discovered, for lots of different reasons, that I think a more compelling reading of the passage is to see that at Sinai, Yahweh is placing his name on his people to claim them as his own. They belong to him. And so he's telling them in the Ten Commandments, don't misrepresent me. I've put my name on you to show everyone you belong to me. Therefore, don't carry that name or bear that name in vain.
Yeah.
So it's much broader than our speech. It would include how we talk about God and how we use his name.
Right.
But I don't think it's limited to that. I think the rest of the law actually fleshes out for us the variety of ways in which we represent God in our business, in our family life, in our international relations. All of these are domains in which we are supposed to be God's representatives.
So rather than taking the Lord's name in vain, it's really taking up God's name, right?
Yes. Yeah,
and bearing his name, carrying his name. You talk about how the priest, the high priest, wears the name of Yahweh on his head, right?
Yes.
As he goes before. Mm-hmm. And he carries the name of all the tribes with him on his ephod, this garment that he takes as part of his priestly vestments.
Yes.
And that's a part of the picture, right? Because it's interesting to think about how, if Christians really thought about it, okay, and we're going to talk a little bit about the transition in a minute. But if Christians really thought about, well, I am representing Christ, mm-hmm. and so stealing is wrong mm-hmm. morally, but mm-hmm. it's also wrong to carry the name of Christ into that particular place where I do steal, whether it's stealing music or software or, you know, clothes or something like that. So how does this, and let's take this to the next level. God's name in the Old Testament is the name Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, right? Mm-hmm. The unspeakable, ineffable name of God. But how does that transition over into the New Testament for Christians? How do Christians sort of bear God's name?
Yeah. Well, let me pick up a piece in Exodus first and then into the New Testament. So you mentioned that the high priest is wearing the name of God. And I just want to make the connection for people so that if somebody's out there listening going, okay, that seems like a stretch. You know, just because the high priest wears God's name doesn't mean they wear God's name. But God has just called them right before he gives them the Ten Commandments. In Exodus 19, he calls them a kingdom of priests. Mm-hmm. And then he says of them in Deuteronomy that they are a people holy, belonging to Yahweh. And he says of them the same thing that's written on the high priest's forehead. And so I think it's not inappropriate for us to be making the connection between the priests and the people. I believe that the high priest is a visual model of the whole nation of Israel. He shows them who they are in a visible way. So on into the New Testament, we can see Peter, when he's writing to his audience of a mixed audience of Jews and Gentiles in his first letter, he calls them a kingdom of priests or a royal priesthood and a holy nation, a people belonging to God. He uses the same titles that were given to Israel at Sinai in Exodus 19. So that's where I get my justification for seeing that we as Gentile followers of Jesus are also part of this Sinai covenant, and we also bear his name. But your question was asking about how, you know, what happens to this in the New Testament. That's what happens to us, but what about Jesus?
Right.
So Jesus comes on the scene, and in many ways he demonstrates that he knows he bears God's name, and he wants to bear it well. So he demonstrates that in a lot of ways. Two quick examples: when he teaches his disciples how to pray, he prays, "Hallowed be your name." And as a kid, I always wondered, why would we need to pray for God's name to be made holy? Isn't God's name already holy? Right. But if you understand that the people of God bear his name and that they're set apart as a holy nation, then anytime they go off the rails, anytime they begin to disobey the covenant or live unfaithfully, God's name is brought into disrepute and God's name is profaned. In fact, Ezekiel 36 uses that language. You profaned God's name everywhere you went because you were so unfaithful to the covenant. So I think when Jesus prays, "Hallowed be your name," he's recognizing that every follower of God, every covenant member, has the task or the vocation of being God's representative. So the holiness of God's name actually depends on us. So Jesus prays that, not hoping that God will do something about it, but in a way of committing himself to making God's name holy by living faithfully to the covenant. So that's one piece. Another place where it's really clear is in Jesus' high priestly prayer in John 17, where he repeatedly says, talks about having made known the Father's name to his disciples. He comes and makes the Father's name known to all of those who listen to his teaching. So Jesus seems to exalt God's name and not be thinking much of his own name. But after his death and resurrection, the early apostles just have this like seamless transition to exalting the name of Christ.
Yeah.
Rather than just talking about the name of the Father.
Yeah.
And so there is an interesting thing. I like how Richard Bauckham puts it, that they included Jesus within the divine identity. And so And so Peter can preach in the early chapters of Acts that at the name of Jesus, every knee will bow and every tongue confess. Like he says there's no other name under heaven by which we must be saved. And he's referring to Jesus' name, but he's just quoted the book of Joel where it's talking about the name of Yahweh as the name by which we must be saved. And he just merges them together and doesn't seem to be bothered by that.
Well, and for Paul, it's, you know, God has bestowed upon him this name, right?
Yes.
The name that is above every name.
Exactly.
And so the name of Jesus and the name of God are just sort of belong together, and they're so closely associated to praise one is to praise the other.
Well,
it's a beautiful book. I tell you, thank you so much for the opportunity to talk about it today.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Been talking to Carmen Joy Imes about her book, Bearing God's Name, Why Sinai Still Matters. Good luck with this. And what's your next project?
I am working on a prequel to this book entitled Being God's Image, Why Creation Still Matters. So I'm going to talk about what it means to be human and what we can learn from the early chapters of Genesis about being human. Because I don't think it's the same thing as bearing God's name, but there are some similarities.
Well, we'll have to get back with you after that's published and talk about that.
Sounds fun.
Dr. Imes, thanks so much for being with us today on the Stone Chapel.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to Brent Johnson and Janet Seifert for editing these podcasts. Thanks as well to Phil Keggy for our music. These podcasts are made possible by the generosity of Mark and Becky Lanier and the Lanier Theological Library Foundation. If you have questions, comments, or would just like to be in touch, please email us at podcast@lanierlibrary.org. Lanier is L-A-N-I-E-R. Thanks for listening.